As long as no one goes to sleep. Okay. It's a very interesting subject, this. Love me, love you. Love you or love me, whichever way round. There's a few different aspects I've thought about this, actually. One is the moral precepts, the code of morality. But there's also some other aspects to this, and I'm going to throw a statement at you made by a very famous teacher, and I want you to answer it, starting off with a question. And he said, you must love your devils and your angels equally. Now I want you to think it over and tell me what you think that means, or why would that be applied in a Buddhist context? Come on in. Come on. Don't be shy. Hello. We're doing mood lighting. You're talking about equanimity? Okay. So you think it's talking about equanimity? Okay, good. Any other questions? Any other answers I mean to that question? I'm sure you've got lots of questions. The what? Unconditional love. You must love your demons and your angels equally. It's a very provocative statement, isn't it? Because in Buddhist morality, we're always trying to get rid of the negative mind. And here's this famous teacher saying, and this is the thing I love about Buddhism, it's not just there. It has many, many ways of entering and ways of looking at life, all with the same basic premise that we don't want suffering and we always want happiness, and that all beings are the same as us. And so therefore we have to pursue happiness. Sounds good, doesn't it? We have to pursue happiness, because otherwise we're pursuing misery. And yet here's this statement that says, you must love your devils and your angels equally. So we've had a comment here that it's about equanimity. It's about us. And how many of us here, I want to see a show of hands, often say to ourselves, I'm no good, I'm hopeless, I'm not good enough. Yeah. Oh, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, I'm not bright enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not handsome enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not. That, believe it or not, is self-grasping. It's still self-grasping, even though it's the negative. It's not walking around going, I'm fantastic. And usually you will find the people that are walking around going, I'm fantastic, underneath, they're feeling, I'm not very good. I better do some advanced PR so people will like me. And so that whole grasping is about, in a sense, as I said, about love me, love you. And this grasping, this devils and angels, is about looking at us as a reality. Yes, we have some negative qualities. Okay? Who has anger as one of their problems? Who gets angry easily? Okay. Who has... who's a shopaholic? Oh, I am. So that's called grasping and the other's anger. And so we all have these different qualities. And there is no point in us going, oh no, that's not me, or oh, aren't I terrible? It's like feeling guilty about something. In the last week I've heard a couple of people say, oh, I feel terribly guilty that I have done that, or that I am going to do that. I feel terribly guilty, but I'm doing it anyway. That is completely useless. If you turn around to someone and say, look, I feel very guilty that I'm going to take your job or take that from you, but I'm going to do it anyway. But I feel guilty. It's kind of this attitude where you're saying, oh, I'm showing you I'm not a bad person, but I'm going to do the bad thing anyway. But I just want you to know that I have a position on. In a sense, that's almost worse than ignorance, isn't it? I feel guilty about what I'm going to do to you, but I'm going to do it anyway. Guilt, one Buddhist monk said to me, guilt is like getting in the car and not starting the engine. It's just an emotion that you think absolves you from responsibility. If I feel guilty, then it's okay. There was a comment someone made to me a while ago. You're getting this, but a while ago, someone said to me, and this is a really interesting comment, and I've heard this a couple of times. Tonight I'm going to throw a few things into the mix, okay? It's about conduct and the way we treat ourselves and others. So this is where it's going to in the mix. And you've given me permission to do that tonight anyway, so I'm going to let it all hang out. This person said to me, oh, I've got this really good friend in hospital who has cancer, and she's dying, and apparently she looks shocking. I'm not going to go and see her because I want to remember her the way she was. Have you ever heard people say that? I think that's actually a very, very bad attitude. I don't want to visit this person because I don't want to see something that's going to upset me. This person is going through death, or heading for death, in a very, very difficult way. But I don't want to go and visit them because, and it's almost a standard line, oh, I want to remember them the way they were, so I won't go and look, or I won't go and say hello. I didn't say anything at the time, but I was really disappointed that this person couldn't see that it wasn't about them. It was about the person that was going through the suffering. And if you can't suck it up and go and see them, then what's happening is that you are being self-grasping. And your mind is not improving when you have that attitude. The only way we're going to get to enlightenment is to develop our compassion and our wisdom. And so that attitude is certainly getting rid of compassion. And the funny thing is, if you remove compassion, then there's no wisdom in that anyway. If you take compassion out of the equation, then you're not very wise. Because unless you understand the suffering of others, and that you may be able to even help, then you're actually not doing very much except wanting and greed. It's greed. I want. I don't want to see anything bad. I don't want to go and visit people in hospital. I just want to have a comfortable life. Do you think that's going to work? No, I don't think so. Because really, Buddhism is about the development of consciousness, development of the mind. And you are not developing the mind by shutting it down, by not actualizing compassion. And so the idea of loving your angels and your devils equally is about looking at the reality of who you are. Not pretending that you're an extremely good holy Buddhist, but there again, not beating yourself up for not being a holy Buddhist. You see what I'm getting at? You have to move forward, but you can't move forward unless you know where you've come from. If anger is one of your problems, if miserliness is one of your problems, if greed is one of your problems, if, you know, we've all got, the Buddha said there were 84,000 delusions, and he taught 84,000 teachings to cure the 84,000 delusions. So somewhere in the Buddhist text, you're going to find something that pertains exactly to your condition, and also the cure. So there's no harm about uncovering the negative stuff about ourselves. But there is harm about indulging it and beating ourselves up about it. I'll tell you a very strange story. I don't think I've ever told this story before, but I will share it tonight, considering we're in mood lighting. I was running a medical clinic, and a guy came to me from, I think it was New South Wales University. And he came to see the therapist at this medical clinic that I was running because he couldn't sleep. And I said, why can't you sleep? He said, because I'm a born-again Christian and I have done something that I feel Jesus has left me. Right? And he said, I feel like I've fallen completely and I don't know where to turn. And it was some complication with a girlfriend that he had. I won't go into the details. But he said, because this girlfriend left him, he felt that he must have done something wrong in the eyes of Jesus for his relationship to break up. Now, the reality is, believe it or not, even Buddhist relationships break up. You know? Everything's impermanent. If he had had a little dose of impermanence in there, he wouldn't have been so freaked out. But he was completely freaked out because his girlfriend went on a Christian summer camp. He felt, and she met someone else, he felt that Jesus had deserted him. And I said to him, I said, so what are you doing? He said, I'm completely lost. I said, well, listen, while you're running around feeling sorry for yourself, there are people out there that maybe need some of your compassion. And he went, ooh. And I said, so it's about time you stopped indulging in this, and maybe your spiritual guide, in the name of Jesus, was actually helping you onto another road. So I said, you've seen it as a disaster, it may be a beginning of a new aspect in your life. And I said, so what you've got to do is start changing your mind to the positive. Because I think from what I understand of Christianity, the doctrine of Jesus is about love and compassion for all beings. Okay? And so here you are doing exactly the opposite by indulging in the fact that you think you've fallen from grace. And I said, on top of that, I've got a meditation for you. And the meditation was a visualization of Jesus. And I said, I want you to visualize Jesus every night before you go to sleep, sending you light and love. He came back 2 weeks later and he was a different guy. He said, that's incredible. He said, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start a club for Christians that feel like they've fallen from grace. All right? For the people that feel bad about themselves. And this was the funny bit. He looked at me and he said, can I ask you a personal question? I said, yeah, sure. He said, are you an angel? And exactly. How do you answer that question? Well, my answer was absolutely not. No, I'm not an angel. I said, but you have to be careful. There are angels everywhere, and there may be an angel walking down the road in a yellow or maroon robe with a shaved head. So they could be everywhere. That was my Buddhist bit. They could be everywhere, so you have to be compassionate to all beings. But you see what happened, I'm using that example, is that we can often feel like we're just not getting it right. But if we indulge in that behaviour, we're really not getting it right. And so we have to go, okay, I'm not going to feel guilty, I've got to have, and I've often used this terminology, and you would have heard it here before, intelligent regret. You heard me say that before? Intelligent regret is recognizing what you've done wrong, working out how you got there, and not doing it again. Getting really clear about that didn't work. It may be gossip, you may have said the wrong thing to someone, you may have been unkind to someone, you know, you may have been in a hurry and been rude to someone and thought, oh, whatever. It could be anything. You work out what you did and say, okay, I'm going to be more mindful about not doing that again. Then you progress. Every time you do a positive action and thought, you are freeing yourself from samsara. Every time you do a negative one, you are binding yourself to the wheel of rebirth. Every time. So, essentially, the whole practice of Buddhism is finding out what creates happiness for yourself and others and doing that. Finding out what creates suffering and misery for yourself and others and not doing that. And luckily we have, 45 years of the Buddha's teaching to give us every instance of possibilities of every way we can think. And so, in a sense, the Buddha gave us a complete template on how to work it out. How to work it out. If you're feeling an emotion or a difficulty or an attitude, you can guarantee that everyone else is. Unfortunately, we are not unique. And in many ways, we are unique. It's always the paradox. We have similar emotions right across the board, and yet the way we view things are really quite individual. And that's fantastic. It gives us opportunities to be of service. And this point about love me, love you, if you don't understand compassion for yourself, it is impossible to give compassion to somebody else. If you don't understand what the feeling is of compassion, then how can you possibly be compassionate and kind to somebody else? Impossible. So the point about Buddhism, in a sense, we're all the same in many ways, but we have this ability uniquely to process information in a way that you can say, okay, is this beneficial? If it's beneficial, it has to be beneficial for yourself and it has to be beneficial for others. Now, you may end up doing some work for somebody and you're extremely tired. Maybe you've got a relative that you're helping and they're difficult to work with and they're grumpy and you get really tired and you're exhausted and you'll go, hold it, they're not so bad, I'm having a terrible time. Where's the good bit for me? But the good bit for you is the training of the mind in being persevering and being compassionate in the face of difficulty, and the merit that you're gaining from the practice. So not always doing something positive for yourself and others is always comfortable. Quite often it's not. But the clarity you develop from doing that and the feeling of positivity you get from that is very tangible. And the more you do it, the better you're going to feel about yourself. But you also have to look after yourself. A classic example of a guy at Shinraising Institute, and we're going way back before, probably pretty much all of you were born, I reckon. 1978. Was anyone born before 1978 in the room? You? Yeah, me too. I wouldn't tell you how old I am. I feel like I'm a very ancient person. But I was at this meditation course, and this woman I knew at Shinraising, I'd been warned that she actually was quite mad. And sometimes mad people are reasonably insightful, even though she was mad. She really did have mental problems. And where a whole group of us were standing in the kitchen, ready to, I don't know, have breakfast or something on the first morning of this 2-week course. And this woman comes into the kitchen and said, "Who's a good Buddhist here?" And this one guy goes, she said, "Right, you come with me." And she gave this guy a box of, I don't know what was in it. And for hours we were watching him walk up the hill and down the hill, up the hill, with her marching behind him. And he didn't stop. Now, I had the luxury of knowing that she was crazy, so there was no way I was going to volunteer and do work for her. In fact, the whole retreat, I avoided her like a plague. When I saw her coming, I was like, whoop, I'm out of here. And anyway, this guy walked up and down the hill for hours until he was just completely exhausted. He could have actually said, "No, look, I've done enough now, I'm not going any further." But because he was trying to be a good Buddhist, what do we call that? Idiot compassion. He wasn't helping her, he was just indulging her fantasy of having someone walk up and down the hill with a box of whatever was, there's probably rocks in it or something, it's probably not important. And he's walking up and down, we're all sitting back going, well, how long can he do this for? Anyway, the very strange thing at the end, right at the end, I'd been avoiding this woman all retreat, and all of a sudden she corners me and she goes, "So why have you been avoiding me all retreat?" Caught. She was kind of good, actually. She used to, when people were meditating in the Gompa, she would stomp around the veranda for, the full meditation. And, you know, if you want to know if your meditation's any good, try and block that out. So, you know, not necessarily a crazy people, not useful. They can be very helpful in mirroring how we're dealing with stuff. You know, who's to say she wasn't a Buddha anyway? We don't know. But it's just that mirroring. But again, you have to look after yourself. This guy didn't look after himself. He just wanted to be a good Buddhist, and he thought the best way is to do what a crazy person says. That's idiot compassion. And so what we need to do is we need to look at ourselves and go, okay, that's not skillful, I'm not doing that well, I'll try and change that. This is what I'm doing here is quite good, I'll increase that, and becoming responsible in situations. Now, I've got a quote here. Morality is the preliminary stage on the path to attain Buddhahood. So, why is morality important in Buddhism? Why is it the preliminary stage before enlightenment? Why morality? Okay, sorry, what? Yeah, well, that's a good point. Morality, why does morality create a peace of mind? You're not guilty of doing bad things. Well, yeah, okay, that's actually reasonable. You know, we know quite innately, if we've grown up in a reasonable culture, we know quite innately what is a good thing to do and what a bad thing to do. We know that it's not good to steal. We know that. That's plainly obvious. Why isn't it good to steal? Because society collapses as everyone steals. So, as a society, it can't work. It creates anger and harm. So that doesn't work. Lying doesn't work. They say that a liar has to have a very good memory. You know? Tell one lie and then the next, and then cover that one up, and cover that one up, and then cover that one up, and then make sure, you know. Too much hard work. Just tell the truth. You know, make your life easier. This is the wonderful thing about precepts and about vows, is they free you. You know, when I first came to Buddhism 30 odd years ago, I thought, oh no, these Buddhists, they've got all these vows they've got to do, and I can't do this, and I can't do that, and I can't do this, and I can't do that, and I can't do this. Oh, it's, you know, so narrow. And then I realised all the things that they said you couldn't do were things I didn't want to do anyway. So I thought, oh, that's not so bad. You know, I wasn't into shoplifting and stealing. I didn't think that was a good idea ever as I was growing up. So that was easy. And then killing. I thought, well, no, I don't really need to kill anything. What do I need to kill? I don't need to kill spiders. You know, I've got great technique for getting spiders out of houses without harming them. I've practiced it. I'm good at it. I know that. You know? I've worked out... this. You know how normally... Okay, here you go. I'm going to share a little thing. You know how normally a spider's on a wall and you try and put a glass over it? And sometimes it doesn't work too well, does it? Sometimes the spider loses a leg or it moves. Better. If you can get a dark glass, it's even better. You put it in front of the spider... and you go and run straight in. Cockroaches too. Okay? Easy. So you find, think about it. Don't do it with a funnel web. Alright? But you can, you know, I think often I said to someone, I hear the Buddhist war cry, it's usually about ants, right? Or mosquitoes. But when you do that, and actually, you know, a little personal thing, I took, you know, Buddhist refuge, but 12 months before I took it, I honestly wanted to know whether I could handle the Buddhist precepts, particularly of not killing. So I practiced consciously not killing for 12 months because I didn't want to fail at this noble practice of Buddhism. And I thought, okay, I'm going to just practice non-killing for 12 months because I know if I become a Buddhist, I'm going to decide not to kill. So I better test it out and see what happens. So for 12 months, I just did it. And for 12 months, it was really easy. And again, I felt free. I didn't have to debate whether I was going to kill a bug or a spider. It was really clear I just didn't do it. And that freed me from ever having to make value judgments. Except, and this wasn't an exception, but I was at a wool shed dance in a place called Berrima, 2 hours from Sydney. And someone said to me, "Quick, in the middle of the floor, look." Now, it was near a bar area. She said, "Come quick." And there was the biggest... Has anyone ever come across a funnel web? Not once, have you? Have you ever seen what they look like? The one at the zoo. Actually, funnily enough, not down this area, but the North Shore actually has quite a lot of funnel webs. They are the nastiest, blackest, hairiest, ugliest fang spider, and they're seriously poisonous. And they can be about this big. And this thing was sitting, and they rear up, ready to strike. And I got fangs, oh, it's just really ugly spider, jet black. So in the middle of the floor was this spider. And all the cowboys, because there's a lot of country guys down there with their Stetson hats and riding boots, were on the bar going, "Ah!" So I went over to the bar and I said to the woman, "Give me a glass." She gave me a little shot glass. I said, "No, can we go a bit bigger than that?" And I walked over and I was absolutely terrified and shaking because I don't like spiders. But what was I going to do? If I didn't save that spider, it was going to get killed. I was the only Buddhist in the room and all these cowboys were terrified. So I went over and I got the glass over him and I slipped a coaster underneath and I'm walking and this spider was so angry. You know, obviously people playing country music and stomping up and down, it upset it greatly. And I ran out into the paddock and I got the glass and it was really long grass and I just went, the glass and everything, and ran. When I came back, one of the cowboys who'd been sitting on the bar screaming said to me, "So did you put your foot on it?" And I went, "Are you kidding?" I said, "Somewhere in the paddock." I mean, I didn't tell him I was a Buddhist and I wasn't going to kill him. But here was this guy's attitude. But look, no one was harmed. The spider survived. I survived. Everyone survived. And the bush dance went on. And so you often indulge. Another time I was at a person's home. It was actually a Jewish person's home, a person I used to massage this woman's husband quite regularly. And I don't even know that I ever told them I was a Buddhist, because I don't go around and advertise the fact. And we just finished the massage and there was this big cockroach running across the floor. And the husband went to put his foot on it and she pushed him back and said, don't, Rod's a Buddhist, he'll save it. Oh, great. So there's wonderful opportunities to get merit. And as I said earlier, not necessarily are they all pleasant. But, you know, that's what you do. That's what you do. If you decide to work within Buddhist practices, then you have to be available to helping humanity and helping all beings. And if you have that attitude, believe me, the situations will arise. Someone will volunteer your services. And so that was one morality of not killing. The morality of not killing. And that allows you to look at bugs, animals, spiders in a completely different way, which is fantastic. But when my son was 7 years of age, he's now well and truly grown up, I heard him saying to the little boy next door that was stomping on ants, just quietly he said to them, said to this boy, you don't need to do that. They don't want to die. Bingo. And the kid stopped. He got it. A 7-year-old got it. It wasn't about, you know, my son was 7. He didn't lecture to him and say, oh, well, you know, this is not a good thing to do, and you know, blah, blah, blah. He just said, they don't want to do that. And the same thing happened to me too. Funnily enough, it was at a retreat on the North Coast, and there was a guy there, and we're in the temple, and this guy was standing there, and he was obviously not a Buddhist, but he'd come to the first Buddhist retreat, and he slaps a mosquito, and I was standing right there, and I said, I wouldn't do that. Jaw, they're trying to eat my blood. And I said, yeah, but they really don't want to die. I remembered what my son had said. I didn't go into a lecture. I wasn't there to give him a moral lesson on Buddhism. It wasn't my right, and he hadn't asked for it. I just made that one statement. They don't want to die. And then I just kind of walked away. A day later, he came back and he said, oh, thank you, man. That was fantastic. He said, I thought about that all night. He said, I really got that. Isn't that fantastic? Teaching from a 7-year-old that I was able to pass on. So, again, this morality allows us to help many beings. Now, that guy, hopefully, never saw him again after that retreat, hopefully he's taken that and he has preserved life from then on. Isn't that amazing? I feel like I've done an amazing job. And it was so small, in a sense. And this is where we can rejoice in the benefit that we can help others. So if you walk around and think, oh, I'm no good, I'm not doing much, you know, in a sense, none of us, until we're Buddhas, are really doing that much. If you look at the number of human beings on this planet that have come and gone, and most of them we'll never know about. But if you can do the opportunity, if you can be mindful enough to have the opportunity to be beneficial in the moment by being aware and not thinking about self all the time, just being aware, then you can be incredible service to humanity. And while you're doing that, you're creating merit, and that merit gives you the opportunity to help humanity and all sentient beings more. And the merit that you create from doing that creates more merit for you to gain wisdom and compassion and the ability to help more. So there's no downside to it. So whatever's beneficial for yourself has to per se be beneficial for others. Okay, any questions? Come on, speak up. Nothing? Ideas? Experiences? Alright, I'll give a quote from the Buddha. This is... Okay. This is a discourse... This is an exchange between Rahul Lal and the Buddha. What is the criterion of morality according to Buddhism? In the admonition given by Buddha to young Rahula, there is the answer. If there is a deed, Rahula, you wish to do, reflect thus. Is this deed conducive to my harm or to others' harm? Or to that of both? Then is this a bad deed entailing suffering? Okay, so... Is the next action I'm about to do going to be beneficial or not beneficial for myself and someone else? Then from such a deed you must desist. Okay, the negative action. Work it out. If there is a deed, Rahula, you wish to do, reflect thus. Is this deed conducive? Is this deed not conducive to my harm, nor to others' harm? In other words, the reverse of that. Is this beneficial for myself and someone else, or both together? Then, is this a good deed entailing happiness? Such a deed you must do again and again. But you need to be mindful to be able to do those deeds. You need to be present. You can't be like the rush, I think on Saturday I said, the rush at Christmas time to get through the front doors and the first day of, on Boxing Day, when the doors open and everyone's elbowing everyone to go and buy the thing that's been inflated and drop the price to exactly what you were going to pay for it anyway. And you're elbowing your way through the doors, pushing everyone out of the road to get the bargain that you must have. I mean, sometimes we're a bit like that. I've missed out on it. Oh no, I didn't get that. Big deal. Yeah. Again, you have to reflect and say, okay, well, you know, look, maybe it's an exam pass you wanted and you tried really hard and you didn't get it. Well, okay, you can feel not so great about it, but you can also sit down and go, okay, well, what do I need to do to fix this? Remember Shanta Davis said, if it can be remedied, why worry? If it can't be remedied, why worry? Work out what you need to fix. Did you study enough? Did you study the right way? You know? And if you put your best effort in, then so be it. Maybe you might have to repeat the subject. Difficult, but it's not impossible. I know someone's just doing some law exams and they put in an essay they thought was really good and they failed in the essay mark. I said, so what are you going to do? He said, oh, I'll have a talk to the examiner to ask them why I failed. That's smart, isn't it? To go and have a talk and say, why didn't this mark, I thought, you know, I got this mark, why didn't I do very well with it? Explain so I'll learn. And that, I thought, was the smartest thing he could do. He was going to go and ask the lecturer why he didn't pass that mark. Because he thought he'd done a good essay. And so he'll learn from that information to improve next time. And this is exactly how we go through life. Good judgment comes from experience. And experience comes from bad judgment. All right? They say the best salesman is the one that's made 1,000 false starts. In science, as a scientist once said to me, even a failed experiment is of great value. He in fact said sometimes you learn. Are there any scientists in the room? Do you agree with that? An experiment that's gone wrong will tell you sometimes more than one that's gone right. Yeah. So there you go. Don't despair if you didn't get it right. Work out what it was. Thomas Edison said that he found 999 ways how not to make a light bulb. How fabulous is that? And it's often said that if the great bodhisattvas on their way to enlightenment stopped because they made a mistake, there would be no Buddhas. And this is about loving me. This is about compassion for oneself. Recognizing that there are times when we don't get it right. And at those times we can work with it. If you're rude to someone, immediately apologize. I'm really sorry. I said the wrong thing. There's no harm in that. An apology is the balm that soothes friendships. It's actually the healing ointment between friendships, an apology. Sometimes it's hard to do, you know, particularly if you feel you've actually been in the right. There may be a situation where someone's done something wrong and you've blasted them for it because they've actually done something wrong. But the way you've done it is quite cruel. It's okay to apologise and say, look, I'm really sorry for the harsh way that I spoke to you. That was unkind. You're not suggesting that everything that they did was correct, but you're recognising that the way you treated them was incorrect. So they may have done some minor misdemeanour, but you've used a whole lot of anger towards them to create a lot of suffering for them. So you can apologise and say, look, I'm really sorry. And that opens the communication again. It's okay to be assertive, to state the truth. It's not okay to be angry. And when you're angry, you don't get anywhere with the other person. It absolutely doesn't fix things. Have any in your experience, have you ever yelled at someone and found out that it just didn't work? It didn't change things, or it made everything worse? It does. It ruins relationships. If you're really angry with someone, it often can break a relationship for life. So it's very, very unhelpful. But being assertive, you can be it in a very strong way and say, look, this is the way things are. If you run a business or you're a boss or something, sometimes you've got to be very clear with people and quite in a strong way. But you're not there to harm them. You're there to get better performance. Again, it's the motivation behind it. Always in Buddhism, there's motivation. Why am I doing this? Am I doing this out of revenge, or I just want to harm them? If that's the attitude, it's never going to work. Never going to work. I often cite the instance of all the mafia bosses and all the criminals that live in this world. They don't seem to end up terribly well, do they? They're either dead or in jail. You know, you look at the Calabrian, the Italian mafia. They're all being rounded up, one after another. They might have 25 years of living the high life with their money, but they're hunted like fish from a shark, the law. So, you know, there's no peace there. It doesn't work for them. Because immoral behaviour will never bring you peace of mind. And so morality is important because it gives you peace of mind. It allows your mind to relax. If you can genuinely say, okay, today I haven't told a lie, isn't that nice? That's really good. Your mind is calm. You don't have to go, oh, that was terrible. I hope they don't find me out. You know, all, what's that Shakespeare said? Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. It gets more and more complex. So, thus, in assessing morality, a Buddhist takes into consideration the interests of both himself and others. Animals not included. Not excluded. So, poor animals. So animals not excluded from our compassion. Even ugly tunnel web spiders that we can save. You remember that... I've said it a few times, when the dilemma, the question, where you come across the ant in the spider's web. Do you remember that one? You remember it? Who hasn't heard that story? Okay, the ant in the spider's web. Who's heard it? You've heard it? Three. You have. Okay, so you guys can't say anything, all right? I'm going to ask the question. You come across a spider's web, with a spider sitting there, and an ant has just got stuck in it. Do you walk away and go, oh, that's nature, or do you save the ant? What do you reckon? Come on, those who don't know the answer, what do you reckon? What do you do? Okay, we'll do it this way. All those that let nature take its course, put your hands up. Okay. Right. All those that would save the ant. Less. Isn't that interesting? Okay, we asked this question of a monk in 1978. This is when I got the answer to this question, and I thought it was fantastic. He said, when you come across the ant in the spider's web, you become part of the equation. Alright? You get that? You've come across the ant in the spider's web. You're part of the equation. And he said, now think logically. If you save that ant, will the spider die? Nah. Come on, it's just missed out on breakfast. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fair enough too. Yeah. That's the problem. But we're saying a really simple thing. It's just got stuck in it. If it's wrapped up in web, there's really nothing. You know how they roll them up? You know, if they've done that, there's not much you can do. No, but we're just talking about, it's just walked into a web. And he said, so if you save the ant, You've saved its life. You've stopped the spider creating negative karma by killing the ant, and the spider won't die and the ant won't die. And I thought that was a really good answer. It made me look at it in the way of, how can I be useful at that particular time? However, if the ant was completely wrapped in web, there's nothing you can do. There's not nothing, because to try and get that ant out of there, you'll kill the ant and possibly wreck the spider's web, and the whole thing falls apart. So that's where you have to use wisdom. There are things you can do. Look, let's face it, when we drive a car, we are killing sentient beings in our car, aren't we? We're driving along. But if we get to the point where we say, okay, I'm never going to drive again, and I'm not going to walk, and I actually won't go and help that person because I could step on an ant. Do you see them? See how that craziness happens? In the Jain religion, does anyone know about the Jain religion here? The Jain religion, in 12 years after the Buddha was born, a great teacher called Mahavira was born. Some thought it was the same person, but Mahavira started the Jain religion. And the Jain religion said that it wasn't actually really possible to get to enlightenment. The best you could do was improve your karma. Right. So the idea of enlightenment, they said, was outside the scale. It was just a mere... Yes. Good. You kill the spider.
Yeah. Even though that I'm going to put the karma, the exact karma out of it, but if I kill a spider, then it's going to save a lot of money.
No. Look, it's good to throw that. This is the thing I like about Buddhism. You can throw this up and let's debate it. Okay, well, what do you think's wrong with that? So, you kill spiders to stop ants being killed. So, if you kill one spider, then you go and do another one, don't you? Because you want to protect all the ants, because you've got a particular bias towards saving ants. Do you get where I'm coming from? How many spiders do you kill to say, oh, that's enough now? See, once you go down that track, you've crossed over. But thank you for bringing that up. But it's not a good idea to start doing that kind of thing, because then you're making a moral judgment on who lives and who dies. And in that sense, all you're trying to do is to see who can live rather than who can die. Yeah, I hear you, but I don't agree with you. And it's the same, you could say, and in fact the Dalai Lama said that. Someone said, is it valid to kill a bad person? He was actually asked this in a lecture at Entertainment Center. And he said, if one bullet could kill one bad man, and there would never be any bad people in the world ever again, then that possibly could be justified under Buddhism. You understand? However, that is not the reality. So unfortunately, killing one spider may protect a few ants, but it is not going to protect all ants. So better not to kill the spider, and better to save the ant if you can. That's really the best judgment you can make. Because in samsara, nothing's perfect. You can't get it perfect. You know, the perfect answer would be to get the spider, take him home, and feed him non-living things. You know? And you've got your pet spiders all over your house that you feed. My son once confessed to me where he was living once. He had a pet cockroach. And I said, what do you mean a pet cockroach? He said, yeah. He said, I used to feed it. It would come up on the thing and he said, I'd give it little bits. He said, I figured if I was feeding it, it was going to be friendly to me. And it wasn't going to cause disturbances. Well, you know, why not? But so that becomes a problem. Unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world. We don't have perfection. Samsara is imperfect. But if we have things like cars, or I was saying about the Jain religion, they believed that the best thing they could do with their karma was to not create any harm. So some of them became what they call skyclad. They wore no clothes. They only ate fruit that dropped off a tree. and they would have a whisk in front of them to sweep the path where they walked. But while they were spending so much time in protecting their karma, who was looking after the poor and the sick in the hospital? See what I'm getting at? If you become so concerned, and this actually happened in Tibet, there was a, when Buddhism came to Tibet, there was the king at the time, it was around about the 7th, 8th century. A king at the time was asked to bring two teachers, one from India and one from China, to debate on which system of Buddhism that they would take, which style of Buddhism. And so the Chinese and the Indian debated, and the Chinese guy, his name was Huashan, said, every movement in the mind creates karma. Right? Just the mere thought will create cause. So our practice is to keep the mind blank, to practice having completely no thought whatsoever, so the mind doesn't move. And the teacher from India said, ridiculous. You are no service to anybody except yourself. Why can't you allow some mistakes in your progress of helping other beings? And the king at the time went, you win, see you, Huashan, and go back to China. So that's why Buddhism was taken from the Indian lineage into Tibet. Because this idea of complete self-centeredness is not very beneficial. You may develop great concentration, you may get samadhi, you may even see emptiness directly, but ultimately you won't get to Buddhahood that way. Because Buddhahood depends on both wisdom and compassion. You can't have a plane with only one wing. It crashes. And these are the two wings. And morality is the basis of how these two, wisdom and compassion, can fly. So I'm going to go through a few things. Well, we've got the five precepts. How are we going for time? Oh, plenty. We've got the five precepts, which is killing, stealing, sexual misconduct and lying. They're pretty obvious. The sexual misconduct one, interesting. One lama was asked, is it okay to have more than one boyfriend? And he said, as long as the other boyfriends are okay with that. So there you go, there's your answer. Girls, if you want to have more than one boyfriend, you have to ask them if it's okay with the others. I doubt whether it'll work, but still. And see, that's a morality, isn't it? It's simple. It's about non-harming. It's about non-harming. In Tibet, interestingly enough, sometimes one woman will marry three brothers. Believe it or not. And that is completely accepted in Tibetan culture, and there doesn't seem to be any problems. And one of the reasons for that was holding on to land that the family owned. So the brothers might have inherited land, and if they got married to three different wives, all that land would be split up and it wouldn't be productive. So they would actually, and in fact I've met one couple, a wife and two husbands. Isn't that interesting? And that happens in Tibet. And because it's accepted custom, there is no immorality in it, because there is no desire to harm or cause conflict. We have this monogamy thing because we think it works, and in many ways it does. But within the Tibetan culture, it seemed to be okay. And I know one lama said he had three fathers. He didn't know which was his father, so he accepted them as all three fathers. And that was acceptable in that culture. Probably not happening today much in Tibetan culture because things have changed. But in that old system, that was fine. So things like sexual misconduct is about harming others. It's not about one narrow kind of view. We've done those. So, actually, I'll go back over this for a moment. the four steps of creating a complete karma. Have you ever learnt these before? You probably have. Someone's probably told you about them. Firstly, you have to have the basis of action. Well, the basis of creating karma is another sentient being. You can't create karma with a cup. All right? I can't abuse that cup and that cup suffer. All right? So there's no karma there. All right? If I do abuse the cup, and some people do abuse inanimate objects when the kettle doesn't boil quick enough, it's creating a kind of an agitated mind, which isn't very beneficial, but you're not actually creating a lot of karma in conjunction. It's with another sentient being, and generally human. So that's the basis, the object. Then you have to have the intention. I am going to do this action. And you then have to do the deed. You have to perform the action, and that action has to be completed, and you have to be satisfied with it. So say I'm going to steal something, so I'm going to steal this. I firstly know that it belongs to you. So the intention is taking this lid from you. I then have the attitude to take it, the motivation to take it. I take it, and I feel, now that I've got it, I feel satisfied that I've completed the job. This is a really interesting point too, because it's the way we can actually purify karmas by recognising these four actions. The basis is the stealing from you. The intention is to steal. The action is to steal. And the completion is that I've got the object and I feel very comfortable about it and happy with it. That's a complete action. Now, as a complete action, that will have ramifications in the sense that it will ripen on us as negative karma. The sad part about karma, well, the good and the bad, is that karma expands. So I may steal a lid, but at a future time, I might lose a whole house. All right? Karma expands. It gets bigger. Conversely, too, if you do a good action, and particularly if you're dedicated, it can expand too. And the case is that when the little girl gave the Buddha a sesame seed, and he predicted that from just that one gift of a sesame seed, she would become a great arhat in later life. So karma expands. So the important thing is, if you've done a negative action, you can stop that negative action by having regret. All right? You've just removed one of the steps for a complete karma. So, in a sense, for purifying, you can purify your negative karma by saying, all the misdeeds that I've done in my previous life, I absolutely regret and renounce doing those, and I'm going to constantly work towards a positive action and positive motivation. And by doing that, you're purifying negative karma. So something that may have been a jumbo jet taking off the ground, all of a sudden becomes very minor. Something that may have was going to kill you might have just been a might have purified it, so it just becomes a headache in this life. It's definitely possible, and the Buddha talks about this. So it's important to know the steps to doing a negative action, and also knowing those so you can purify them. So we'll just look at some of these. Divisive speech. Divisive speech. What do you think the motivation is? To create disunity, isn't it? To split people up. Do you know so-and-so doesn't like you very much? Bingo. Don't they? I thought we had a good relationship. Nah. I think you're really crummy. Bingo. Divisive speech. You've just created what they call a schism. You heard the term schism in the Sangha? That's one of the ways you can do it. And so, the delusion is one of the three poisons. For example, you can do it out of anger, creating hostility and disharmony among people you dislike, out of attachment, causing a rift between a couple in order to have a relationship with one of them. All right. So if it's a boyfriend-girlfriend thing, you can kind of undermine that because you want to have a relationship with the person and you get the other one the rival out of the road, and out of ignorance, believing that disharmony is healthy, or causing disunity among followers of a religion you disagree with, believing this to be positive. See, that was the situation when I thought about this guy. You remember I talked about the clinic. Here this guy was a Christian. Now, if I was a zealot, you know the word zealot? If I was a zealot, I could have gone, oh, perfect opportunity to turn this guy into a Buddhist. He's having a bit of a problem with his Christianity. Now, I'll just get in there and shift everything. Do you think that would have been kind? Ooh, another Buddhist, great. Bring him in. Do you think that would have been kind? That's not the Buddhist way, is it? That's harming. That's causing harm. So what I did was helped him with his own path. That I considered to be the Buddhist way. With a little bit of, you know, an angel might be a Buddhist, so watch out. And actually he wrote to me, and funnily enough, the end of that story, he wrote to me about 3 months later and said, thank you so much for giving me back my faith. I have started this little club of people that feel like they've fallen from grace. It's doing really well. I'm very happy. Everything's going really well in my life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So, great. Fantastic. So it's not about creating disunity because you think it's a good idea. I had some Christian guys come to my flat one time, and they said, what religion do you follow? I said, I'm a Buddhist. And they said, well, you know, we've got a guy who was a Buddhist and he's become a Christian. What do you think of that? I was incredibly aggressive. I was quite surprised. I said, well, that's fine. Is he happy? He said, yes, very. So what do you think of that? I said, well, I think that's great for him. Well, don't you think you should change? And I said, no, I don't think I should. And I don't really want to discuss changing or not changing. And he went, ugh. He said, can we come back and talk to you again? I said, if you must. I never saw them again. And then I get some Jehovah's Witnesses coming to my front door. And, you know, they've got their watchtower, and I'm always sweet to them. They've never asked me what my religion is, and I've never volunteered. I've said to them, I am not of their faith. And they think by coming to my door and saying nice things about, and sometimes the quotes are actually quite Buddhist, you know, do unto others as you would do unto, you know, yourself, and things like that, which are very, very Buddhist logic. And I go, yeah, that's great, I really like that thing. And every few months they'll pop up, and they always bring someone new along, right? I think they've probably said, well, we've got someone in training, we know this guy won't yell at us and slam the door, so we'll bring the new person along. It's very funny. I'm very amused. And the other day I had a watchtower under the front door. It says, we've looked for you. You've been out so often. I hope you still live here. But I don't see a problem with that. You know, I'm not leading them up the garden path. I often say, look, you know, I don't have a lot of time. I don't spend hours talking to them. But it's not about creating disunity even for their religion. I'm not going to try and prove to them that their religion isn't the way I think, or it's not clear in logic and this. You know, that's their faith, and we should actually honour that. And Buddhism is really about that. So we don't ever try and change someone's religion. It's really important. Harsh speech, what else? Idle gossip. This is a good one. Idle gossip. Recognition, you believe that what you wish to say is important or meaningful, although it is not. Motive, you intend to express such words. So, of the delusions, out of anger, chattering idly in order to disturb someone you dislike who is trying to meditate or do something virtuous. Out of attachment, indulging in gossip or frivolous talk about things you're attached to, or spend time with someone you're attached to. Out of ignorance, thinking there's nothing wrong with spending time in idle gossiping. I see gossiping a little bit worse than that in many ways. It's about creating disunity in a sense. When someone says to you, oh, what do you think of so-and-so? Oh, they're pretty honest. You know, they're not such a bad person. Already you've just tainted something. However, if you do know the person is a thief, you can say to someone, well, actually they're a thief, so I'd be careful. It's not about avoiding all situations. But gossip's really about becoming a little bit superior. You know how people gossip? Did you know so-and-so did that? Oh, isn't that terrible? You know that kind of attitude? What you're creating is a superior attitude to other people. You know the inside story. Right? And it happened to me once, and a guy was really clear with me. I knew the inside story about this particular, he wasn't a Buddhist teacher, but this particular teacher was, he was a bit chonky, and he was having a lot of affairs with married people. He wasn't a Buddhist, so I can't say that he was, you know, he wasn't following a Buddhist morality. And this person said to me, oh, I think this guy's really great. And I said, oh, you know, I think his morality's a bit chonky. Because I wasn't really happy with the guy's attitude in life, you know. And he said to me later, he said, oh, you really disrupted my view of that person. And I said, oh, look, I'm really sorry. I said, I think really I did gossip on that level. My motivation was that this friend of mine shouldn't really take this guy's morality as being very pure. But then some of the words he said were probably quite good. So, you know, there was a very grey line. I think I went the wrong side of it. And I've been very careful since not to do that about other people. You know? Even though I thought at the time I was a bit worried that this guy was going to take this bloke's advice and that, you know, he wasn't that great. And the problem being is that because I feel very strongly about morality, I was kind of a little bit wary that I knew this guy, this teacher's actions weren't really very wholesome. But in the end, I think I was the one that did the incorrect judgment. I think I actually gossiped in that situation, and I kind of regret that I did that. And I was very mindful, and I apologised to him and said, yeah, I think you're right. And I was very mindful of not doing that again about that person. So you have to be mindful at the time. And sometimes your motivation may seem correct, but later down the track you go, yeah, it was a bit wobbly. That's when you look at it and you don't beat yourself up. You go, okay, that was quite clear. I got that one. I'm not going to do that again. And you move on. And this is about not having harsh judgment on yourself. Not indulging your negativities, but not beating yourself up about them either. Again, the middle way. I think you're with me on that, aren't you? You do get that, what I'm saying on that. That you have to be careful about this self-negativity, self-aggrandizement, but also recognizing what you've done wrong. And just being very clear about that morality. What else have we got? We've got a few here, things like harmful intent. One of your friends is emotionally harmed by someone with bad intent. We often feel quite justifiably angry at them, don't we? And we think, oh, well, they'll get their karma. That's harmful intent. Oh, well, they deserve that. It's very difficult for Buddhists, and Buddhas have compassion for all beings without exception. Buddhas have compassion for all beings without exception. And that's very difficult for Buddhists sometimes to follow. Because someone that has been harmed greatly by somebody else, you can feel very, very disturbed by that action of the negative person. That's fine, but you still have to have compassion for them. That's why Buddhists don't believe in capital punishment. That's why the Buddha said that you must never tell a prisoner that they will never be released, no matter how bad their action has been. And the logic behind that is looking at our lives from beginningless lives. We have had no beginning to our lives. We have always existed. Our consciousness stream has always existed. If it's always existed, then 13 billion years ago, when this planet was formed, we were somewhere else. But when the universe happened. And before that universe, and before that universe, and before that universe, and before that universe, we have never not existed at some point in time. So therefore, we have all done the worst negative things and the best negative, the best positive things in our previous lives. We have killed people, we've been in armies, we have done terrible things. At this point in time, we have what we call a perfect human rebirth, where we can create positivity. But in a previous incarnation, mightn't be even in this world cycle, we have done some extremely bad things. It's said that we have traversed all the realms of samsara, from the hell realms to the god realms, to the hell realms to the god realms, and we've kept rotating. Constantly. So therefore we've done some very negative actions. So therefore even the beings that have done very negative actions, yes, we can feel compassion for the victims and feel, in a sense, negativity towards the actions, but we can't lose compassion for those beings. And that's a tough call. There was a story of the Buddha who was, in one incarnation, he was a hermit living in a forest. And a king was riding with his wife. He was out hunting, and the wife got bored and she wandered off into the bush, and she came across the hermit, this holy sage. And she said to this sage, "Can you give me teachings?" And he said, "Okay." So he's giving her a discourse. The king comes along and he says, "You've been fooling around with my wife." And the Buddha is describing this, and he said, "Yes, in that incarnation I was a hermit." He's recalling this as a Buddha. And he said, "What happened?" And I think it was Nanda was asking the question. He said, "What happened to you?" And he said, "Well, the king tied me up and started torturing me. He started cutting off my flesh, bit by bit." And Nanda said, "Did it hurt?" He said, "Sure, hurt. Yeah, absolutely it hurt." And he said, "Well, weren't you angry at the king?" He went, "No." He said, "I knew that my previous karma had created this situation. And for me to be angry at the king would create it again, and I wasn't going to go through it twice." He was really determined not to be angry at the king while he was being tortured. Now, extreme control of the mind to be able to handle that. There's a monk who lives at our Buddhist centre who hadn't escaped from Tibet. And he'd been put in a communist Chinese concentration camp and had been tortured badly. And I said to him directly, I said, "How do you feel?" He said, "I am not angry to the Chinese communists." And he was really tortured very badly for over a year or so, and then let go. And he said, "I do not have anger towards them." And a monk that escaped once from, again, he'd had 18 years of imprisonment and torture. And the Dalai Lama asked him what his greatest fear was, and he said that "I would lose compassion for my torturers." And this is a strong belief to be able to handle that, and a strong belief in karma. You know? If it's happening to you, it's a result of previous causes and conditions. It's not God doing it to you. It's not someone else doing it to you. It's your causes and conditions you've created. So therefore, you have to, at that point, have an attitude that changes that. And if anger got you the experience of that negative karma ripening, then anger will do it again. So you have to drop it. You have to drop it. A friend of mine ran a Buddhist centre called the Ocean of Peace in, where was it, Darlinghurst. Most bizarre Buddhist centre. He accepted everybody as long as they weren't intoxicated. So there were transsexuals, there were bisexuals, there were every kind of strata of humanity, weird humanity you could imagine, would come to his Buddhist center. And they were all welcome, no matter what kind of persuasion they were all welcome. Except if they were drunk, and then he'd throw them straight out. So you come back when you're sober. And one evening, he heard this terrible commotion. He went downstairs, and there was a little transvestite, very little, being harassed by this big guy with tats and a bald head, and he was just about to hit this person. And my friend stood in front of this one, put her behind him and said, "No, you can't do that. Don't." And he said the guy went bang, hit him with this incredible punch in the jaw. He said it lifted him in the air. He said he hit the ground and he got up and went. And guess what happened? The thug screamed and ran off. He hit my friend with everything he had, and my friend gets off the ground and bows to him. It terrified him and he ran away. Incredible story. Incredible bravery to be able to do that. There you go. So, you know, those are actions that are amazing that you can hear people do. But it came from his Buddhist training. And that friend of mine was actually the person that got me involved in Buddhism. 1976. He was the guy that actually got me involved in Buddhism. And every morning at 3 o'clock he gets up and does 2 hours practice. And has done since 1975. And he runs a business. He was married for a while. He's got a couple of boys. He has this great life. He's happy. He makes good money. And he's unbelievably generous with it. Gives money away all the time. And that comes out of his Buddhist practice. He doesn't really go to any centres. He's kind of like a yogi, actually. And he's the guy that actually presented Buddhism to me, so you know, I feel very privileged to have been in his company and still in his company. Great wisdom. So anyway, where were we? Harmful intent, wrong views. Well, wrong views is another one. Now, what do you think the wrong views are? The first wrong view is the fact that karma doesn't exist. That's the worst wrong view in many ways, that karma doesn't exist, that whatever you do, karma only happens when you get caught, I think someone said. Which is an interesting take on it, isn't it? Well, as someone else said to me, "Oh, if you don't believe in karma, it doesn't happen to you." I mean, we exist on the fact of cause and effect, don't we? Everything we do is in a relationship to a cause and an effect. You know, if I pick this up and it turns into a kangaroo, then okay, we can say everything's random. But it doesn't kind of happen that way. It's a cup, we fill it with tea, I can drink the cup, you know, I can drink the tea. We work on that basis. So wrong views is saying that karma doesn't exist, or that a negative action brings a positive result. All right? I'll just steal this money and give it to a poor person. You know? I'll steal a lot more money and give it to a lot more poor people. That's a negative, thinking that a negative action is going to create a positive result. It cannot happen. Okay, another question. A bank robber steals money from a bank and he's happy about it. He's very happy. Just got $10,000. just got 10 grand out of the bank. He didn't get very much, but he got 10 grand. And he's really happy about it. Well, hold it. He's just done a negative action, and he's got a positive result for himself. How does that work? Well, the truth of it is the positive action was going to happen at some point anyway. But that was not the cause. The stealing was not the cause of the positive action. The stealing karma has not ripened yet. And one of the big things between cause and effect is actually, in true karma style, is that there is a big gap between the cause and the effect. Alright? So, as you're cheating on the tax department and your bank account's going down at the same level, you'd stop immediately, wouldn't you? If you were stepping on a bug and your back was breaking, you would stop immediately, wouldn't you? So it's not like that. There's a gap between the cause and the effect. Why is there a gap? What's the factor that creates, that stops it being instantaneous? What do you think it is? Conditions, exactly. Causes and conditions. If you don't have the causes and conditions, then a karma cannot ripen. Which is really interesting, because if you walk around being angry, you are creating the conditions for angry things to happen to you. Perfect. I walk around. Something's going to happen. Try walking into a very rough pub. Like that. Guarantee you something's going to happen. You've just created the conditions for probably a lot of violence. And it's those causes and those conditions which are wonderful, because we can use it. Because if we develop a peaceful mind, we are creating the conditions for more peaceful things to arrive. Now, that doesn't mean that karma doesn't catch up with us and negative things happen. But again, when something negative happens, if we create a positive moment at that point. It was like my friend. Yes, he got hit in the jaw, but he actually gave a blessing to that guy. And he was not harmed. That's amazing. And he has created the cause for that guy in the future to help him at another stage in another lifetime. That thug may end up having something negative happen to him, but for this guy, that guy will turn up as his friend. Amazing, isn't it? The person that's done something wrong to you, by you creating the positive cause in that thing, that will ripen the later stage into positive effect. Maybe when my friend becomes a Buddha, this will be his first disciple. Who knows? You know? It can happen. By having that kind of attitude. So every moment that we're experiencing karma, we have an opportunity to change the way we think and to change the positive karma from negative. If you want a nasty person to go away, be nice to them. Be patient to them and be kind to them. All right? It's not about losing your boundaries either. Okay? You don't, it's not, again, idiot compassion. You know, if someone's going to do something negative, you can say, okay, now look, I'm not going to be part of that, or I don't want you to do that. You can be straight down that line. It's not being silly about it. But if you're in a situation where someone is just really giving you a hard time, if you continually work with that person, persevere, see them as a practice of patience, then eventually that person will change, or they will leave. They'll just walk out of your life. I know for a fact it's happened to me, and I won't go into the story, but it's definitely happened to me, where I had a negative person in my life for many years, and I just said, okay, this person is going to be my practice of compassion, and one day they just left. Karma finished. I had to put up with it, but karma finished. Because if, say you've got a really difficult boss, you're in a job, and you've got a really difficult boss. If you constantly think harmful thoughts towards this boss, you are just creating a heap of negative energy for yourself, and you're not, it's not going to work for you. If you constantly persevere with love and compassion, even though it's difficult, you will transform yourself, and that the situation will happen shorter. Because the fact that they're negative to you is due to your causes and conditions you've created in the past. If you keep doing it, it's going to continue, isn't it? If, however, at that point you go, okay, I've recognised this person is a result of my own karma, I act in a positive way, then it's going to work out. So again, going just back to love me, love you. If we have compassion for ourselves and compassion for all other beings, as much as we can all the time, then we are creating this positive environment for us to live in. And people will come along and look after you. When you think of the worst possible situation, something will happen. And it's like you create the causes and conditions for people to be your helpers, not your detractors from your life. And so this is about creating, constantly creating harmony, creating compassion for ourselves in our negativity. And the point I want to make also is that if we recognise our devils, then when we see it in someone else, we don't have to be judgmental. Oh, I wouldn't do that. Of course you would. Of course you'd do that. You know, that superior, oh, look at that. I'm better than that. If we let go of that and go, yeah, well, okay, I do negative things too. I have done negative things. I'm doing the best I can. They're doing things out of the three poisons. But I have to actually forgive them, because I do it too. I've done this stuff too. And the more you work on that, the greater harmony that you have around you. As the Dalai Lama said, I don't see strangers, I just see friends I haven't met yet. It was funny, on the way to this law building tonight, this guy, I was just outside the law building and I'd come from a different direction. And I was kind of, and this guy walked out and I said, is that the law building? He went, no. I went, oh, I'm walking down. And I asked someone else, and I went, no, it's that one. I went, oh, that guy gave me the right, you know, like, and I thought, I was trying to work it out, and I thought, I don't think he was trying to be nasty. I think he actually just didn't know. Now, I could be really angry at you, so no big deal, but say I was running late for something. I could go, oh, that guy, oh, you know. And then I thought, oh, I hope that guy doesn't feel embarrassed at another time that he's given me the wrong directions, because I know I would. I feel terribly embarrassed about something that happened to me in Italy. I think I'm going to get thousands of years of bad karma for this one. And maybe that was the ripening I just got. Hey, I just thought about that. I was in Italy. I was in Rome. I was travelling around by myself. And it was a really hot day. It was the middle of summer. It was really hot. And I was walking down through some markets, and this old nun came up to me. She was dressed in a black habit and everything. And she said, excuse me, in broken English, stazione. She wanted to know how to get to the station. And me, thinking I knew Rome really, I said, oh, it's down that way. And when she walked off, I went, oh, no, it's that way. Oh, my goodness, I've just sent her off on a wild goose chase. And I went, up, and there was a sea of nuns, all with black habits. No way I could tell which one was which. I thought, oh no, I've just sent this poor old nun to get heat stroke somewhere in Rome. So maybe that was the ripening I just got. Now, it was out of ignorance. I really thought I was being helpful, but I should have just gone, I'm not sure. Right? But I decided to practice my broken Italian honour and then. Yeah. So I hope she survived. But anyway. I think we'll leave the lecture there on the poor nun still wandering around looking for the station 20 years later. And if there are any other questions. So do you get the point about love you, love me? It's about morality, and it's about compassion, and it's about compassion to ourselves and compassion to others. And being moral gives us a really strong, the precepts give us a really strong basis of how to act. We don't even have to check up all of them. We just have to say, is this going to be beneficial for ourselves and others? And just working that out. And that's really the basis of our whole spirituality. Thank you, folks. Great to see you again. Have a break. Enjoy your break. How long have you got? 2 weeks? 3 weeks? All right. Good luck, everyone. Thank you very much. Yeah.
So,
okay.
How do you
believe, and I've investigated this, and that is the general consensus. It's also American spin. All right? Because at that point, why did they do two bombings? Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I really believe the Americans were testing this bomb out to see what it would do to humans. I honestly believe that. I think it was an extremely negative action. And it looked like, during the Second World War, that the Japanese were about to capitulate and surrender anyway. All right? And why couldn't they have picked an uninhabited island, at least, and said, this is what we're going to do if you guys don't stop? You know? There could have been a million ways to stop that. They put the spin on it and said, yes, we stopped World War III by doing that. Weren't we fabulous? There was no other way. A lot of historians now disagree. You can justify just about, you know, even murderers have excuses, don't they? You know? And in that case, I feel quite horrific about that. I was involved in the early 70s in Australia. They had conscription. The Vietnam War. Are there any Vietnamese people here? No? Yeah. Yeah. And this was conscription for the Vietnamese War, right? And as you know, the Americans had gone into Vietnam and Australia had gone into Vietnam because there was this propaganda that said that communism was going to take over the world and we had to go into Vietnam to stop it. And I, and like a lot of young people, had got conscripted into the army and then sent to Vietnam. And my mother said, what are you going to do if you get conscripted? I said, I'll do two things. I said, I'll do the army training. It doesn't matter, I'll be in Australia and do the army training. And when conscription comes to send me overseas, I will not go. They can throw me in jail. I'll escape. I wasn't a Buddhist at that stage. I just believed it was completely wrong. And many, many young people in our country, and we had huge moratoriums and marches against it. But the machine, and the same, I did the same thing. I marched against the Iraq War. Iraq War, we have 700,000 civilians have been killed in that war. They talk about 24,000 American soldiers, but 700,000 Iraqi citizens have been killed in that war. I remember my teacher talked about the bombing of Afghanistan. You know, when they did the blanket bombing of the ranges, he said, very quietly, he said, think of all the little animals that have been destroyed in that bombing. Think of all the little creatures that have been blown up and maimed while they're dropping those bombs. So, you know, as far as Vietnam went, I believed it was wrong, and history had proved that it was a wrong, completely wrong decision. The same as Nagasaki. Wherever you see mass destruction and war, you can guarantee that it's wrong. Now, okay, I can see the point of building up a big army so that some crazy person doesn't do anything as a deterrent, but not to go in and start blowing up people, making landmines. There's still companies in the world and countries making landmines. I mean, it's just appalling behaviour. We talk about civilization. I don't think the world has got to it yet. En masse. You know, you look at America doing capital punishment. And they reckon that 20% of people executed in America are innocent. 20% have never done the crime. And they've even said, oh yes, we checked with DNA later and we found out that guy was in it. It's just happened in West Australia. Two guys have been in jail for 15 years for murder they didn't commit. And the authorities said, yeah, we're sorry, yeah, it wasn't you. You know, I mean, that's why when you talk about killing and things, there is no excuse, because it doesn't work. The Dalai Lama has had a problem a little bit with some Tibetan youth, because the Tibetan youth are getting very upset about the communist invasion of Tibet, and they want to become militant. And the Dalai Lama says, no, because the moment you start becoming terrorists, even if you think it's justified, the world will turn on you. Suicide bombing does not bring about any action except killing and destruction. So there's no, you know, and so after all that, going back to the original question, I believe that it was an American spin and it was an experiment to see what they could do. And I think it was completely wrong. And I think, yeah, as I said, many historians believe that it was going to finish anyway. And look, I'm not putting down soldiers who fought in the wars and what anything. Look, that's, you know, people do the best they can with what they've got. Samsara is imperfect. But I think from our own stance, from my personal stance, I will not go to war. I will not pick up a gun and shoot people. Not in this country or any country, because I believe firmly of it. In many ways, as a Buddhist, it's better for me to be shot than it is for me to shoot someone. For me to be shot is the end of my karma. For me to shoot someone is the beginning of my karma. And the Dalai Lama said that about the communist Chinese. He said, for the Tibetans, it's the finish of a karma. But for the communist Chinese, it's the beginning of a karma. He said, we should have more compassion for the Chinese communists. Isn't that an incredible sort of attitude? So we have to constantly, in a sense, back up our convictions with our actions. If, you know, as Buddhists, if we believe that we can create a better harmony, then we create better harmony. We can't half do it. And so when, you know, the American idea comes about where we say, oh, well, if we drop a bomb, that's going to fix everything. No, it's not. You know, and the number of people that died and the radiation and the suffering that created was just horrific. And I think there could have been, yeah, show a deterrent, but not carry out the action. Anyway, thanks. Yeah, sure. Please go ahead. Yeah.
What do you think, good karma or bad karma, when Obama ordered and killed Osama?
Yeah.
So which one, the killer is Israel, but he is the instruction
of Israel. So okay, I believe in that situation they should have tried to capture him. All right, and I think they should have.
Osama.
Yeah. Yeah. I think. Sorry. Well, see, the point being, it looks like, you know, the way it's said, oh, we've got rid of an evil man, but he is one of many in that organisation that think wrongly that killing is a good thing. I believe it would have been more powerful to capture him and take him to trial in The Hague, like they've done with the Bosnian guy, and to expose the wrongdoing for the world to see, rather than making him a martyr and harming and killing him. I don't believe that people shouldn't be brought to trial. I think there should be justice in the world. You can't just let people do things willy-nilly all over the place. But I think I wasn't happy about that at all. And I was really disturbed that Americans were rejoicing. This is not a thing to be rejoiced at. This is the killing of someone who was in conjunction, involved with the killing of thousands of people in the Twin Towers. Why are you having a party? The whole thing's linked. This isn't a time to be rejoicing. There's great suffering involved in the whole thing. And on top of that, as Thich Nhat Hanh actually said, the great Vietnamese teacher, Buddhist teacher, he said, they asked him what he would say if he came across Osama bin Laden. And he said, I would ask him why he is so angry. And what situation in the world has created someone to be in that situation? the amount that America spends on arms, or even in the Iraq war, it's $3 billion they've spent on the Iraq war, could have fed every poor person in the world. You feed people, give them good conditions, you are not going to feed the disenfranchised terrorists, are you? So we've got it wrong, you know. We go, oh well, we'll create this huge war machine to protect us. Why don't we drop food instead of bombs? Do you see the different attitude to it? And so in that sense, I believe it could have been done in a different way. I wasn't there, so I can't actually answer it. But killing someone is negative karma. Well, I mean, he created the karma to be killed, in a sense, through his actions, and I'm not condoning his actions. So he was a negative person. But it's negative karma. The fact that he was killed is negative karma. You cannot kill someone and say it's positive karma. So the person that killed him... Okay, I'll give you an instance. There is a right... There was a right in... Is everyone okay with this? Okay. Go if you have to go, please. There was a rite in ancient India, right, where a Hindu person, a particular sect, believed that if they put a trident on the ground, you know, a trident, a three-pronged staff, and jumped out of a tree and was able to pierce their forehead, their neck and their heart, they would become a great avatar and go to heaven and help many sentient beings. Right? They believe this wholeheartedly. From the motivation, this is how one Buddhist teacher said, the fact that they killed themselves, a sentient being, killing a sentient being is killing a sentient being, whether it's yourself or someone else, they would have ended up in a hell rebirth, but because of a positive motivation, they would have been a little higher up the hierarchy in hell. All right, they might have been an overseer rather than one of the inmates. So we can have a positive motivation that can have some kind of effect, but the result of a negative action is always a negative result. You can't, you know, people say, oh, we've got rid of this terrible person. But really in the Al-Qaeda situation, there's going to be more coming through. It hasn't fixed it. You know, maybe it would have been better at some point to sit down in the early stages and had serious talks with him before he became the full Al-Qaeda terrorist. Serious talks with him by America, say, listen, how can we help you? What is your problem? Is it poverty? You know, what is it that we can do to work together? I believe really dialogue is really, really more important. And the Dalai Lama warned many years ago, they said, what do you think about killing Osama bin Laden? He said, I think it will be a negative action and will cause more suffering. You know? That's the hard bit. So, again, sticking to the Buddhist principles of non-harming is really, really, really important, even when it looks like it's a justifiable action. Because sometimes the propaganda will be wrong. You know, you could, and forget about killing. Someone says, "Oh, see that person over there? They're a really bad person. They're a really bad person." And if everyone says that enough, we will go around thinking that person is a really bad person, and they may not be at all. And that's the propaganda machine. And all countries use it, and they manipulate all the time. You know?